It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Welcome to the It's Going Down podcast. We are joined here today with three people involved in the new book project, Liaisons, with the first issue pertaining to an autonomous anti-capitalist critique and analysis of the rise of populism across the world, including in the U.S. and in Mexico. You all have also embarked on a tour with the book, too, correct?
Yeah, we did. We've done two tours now so far. We did a tour back in August. We were in the Midwest and the South, and we just got back from kind of a mid-Atlantic Northeast tour. So we made it down to D.C., Philly, Baltimore, and then kind of last Sunday in New York.
Anything you want to say about the tour? Any crazy stories from America?
Definitely. I think the tour of the Midwest and the South was longer. So we kind of had an interesting time to meet a lot of people. That was like an eye-opening tour, but this was pretty quick. But I don't know if we have too many crazy stories. Maybe somebody has something to add.
Well, maybe one thing to add is that the book actually came out also in France, in French, and in Quebec in French too. So it's published in three different countries. And we toured France in the beginning of the summer, and we definitely saw like a difference in engagement, you know, with the kind of ideas and maybe the kind of tone that the book proposes. In France, the events were pre-packed and was kind of easy, you know, to jump really fast into like intense discussions on these subjects. And in the US, sometimes it was harder to get to people to discuss, let's say. Yeah. So this is one of the challenges of this project, is to be able to kind of create those spaces of discussion, you know, that happen simultaneously in different places, in different languages.
Gotcha. And the book itself is about the rise of populism and looking at the situations in various countries where there is a populist surge, correct?
Maybe I can jump on this one. I think one thing that really comes out of the book as sort of a central, you know, shared position is definitely a critical position against, you know, contemporary populisms. But that does not go in the classical way or the classical sense of sort of coming back to more, you know, moral or democratic, notions of what politics should be. And so instead of clinging to older classical categories for political sphere, the texts are engaging more with this idea that populism, as we see it, you know, return today in many places, actually feeds on the absence of the people. And it is not a return of the figure of the people, as we hear in a lot of kind of commentaries, you know, today. A lot of think pieces about that and, you know, the more liberal world. And we think it's actually because there is an absence of a real antagonism or political conflictualities have been erased. And this is where populism comes at play, you know, as sort of like a projection on that absent figure. And in this sense, the book tries to actualize, you know, the autonomous tradition of thought, which I don't know if people are familiar with it, but the autonomous, let's say, school of thought started mostly in the 70s, the 60s, 70s in Italy, and then traveled to Germany and France, and had a great influence on a lot of thinkers that we still read today. And this school of thought kind of tries to establish that there is a necessity to leave the field of politics to be able to accomplish, you know, something that would be like a real revolution. So this is kind of like how the book tries to engage with the question of populism. How do you escape it? How do we not let struggles being reframed in its terms?
In some way, it doesn't, it doesn't put forward like a central theory per se of populism, but it was kind of more of a provocation in a way to hear about how friends from kind of different places around the world were dealing with populism. But I think there is kind of like we saw several themes and kind of this insight that populism is this fiction that is wielded in a certain way as an empty signifier with this in these kind of linguistic games. There was that kind of insight about as a figure, kind of as she was saying about as an absent, this absent people, this kind of fiction that's wielded in certain ways.
In the introduction to the book, it argues that within the crisis of neoliberal legitimacy, we are seeing a rise in both left and right populisms. Can you give us some examples of this crisis and how it's playing out across the world?
I guess there's multiple ways in which this crisis is apparent. Some say it's a crisis of legitimacy. We're trying to think of it as a crisis even in what is the basis or sort of like this basic social contract that, you know, the liberal order sort of proposed and was able to maintain for a couple of decades in, at least the Western world. And tries to establish elsewhere. And the basis of that order is sort of this idea of representation, right? Which is the key that will provide pacification of, of real conflicts and violence and oppressions, and will sort of keep us away from, risk of civil war or social war. And this idea of representation, this system of representation seems to have come to its limits. In different experiences, we kind of see how there is a sort of, like a deep refusal that is building. And I don't think this refusal is necessarily positive or productive in a revolutionary sense. It's mostly just neutral. It's sort of indifference to the social order and its mobilizations. So yeah, it can be called a refusal of being governed, and we can definitely see some more contemporary movements that clearly articulate it even in those terms, we are ungovernable. And things like that. But we can also see this crisis in contemporary effects that are sort of like prevalent, like, conspiracy thought, and this sort of just general mode of distrust, that kind of touches more and more people around us. So, this idea that everything is always fake, that everyone is kind of manipulated, behind every movement or behind every, political force, there's something else that stands. This can also be understood as, the result of an accumulation coming from, decades of liberal order trying to establish representation, like its own hegemony as the only way of perceiving reality, basically. So I think that's something that's becoming more and more, something that less people can deny. And this is where populisms feed on, on this refusal and this distrust, basically.
The other question that this begs is that, what does this mean for autonomous anti-capitalist movements that have been fighting against neoliberalism? What does it mean that it rose to such prominence and then 20 years later we're left with people like Alex Jones and Trump screaming about globalists, for instance? So the question has to be asked, is the rise of everything from Bernie Sanders to Golden Dawn a testament to the failure of post-crisis movements from Occupy to the Arab Spring?
Yeah, I think definitely it is. And I think, you know, kind of, you know, I think that question kind of provides an answer to itself in a certain way. This is kind of what we're left over with after these attempts. And I think these were early kind of really interesting attempts of, you know, mass experimentation. I think they kind of opened a new order in a certain way, a new break, you know, these expressions of revolt. But I think we're still in a time of learning and figuring out how to carry that energy on. I think between the uprisings, between the higher peaks of struggle. But I think, you know, these populisms have kind of presented themselves as the predominant mode in which, people can resist and maybe refuse or fight back against, this order and decline that has lacked a lot of legitimacy. So I think, you know, I think we see that both on the right and left. Throughout the world, and a lot of the texts attest to that.
Yeah, I think it's also connected with what our other friend was speaking about, the refusal to the liberal order not being positive per se, but more of a, you know, neutral, sort of, you know, a very neutral refusal, just of a, like a bored refusal of the liberal order. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily like the responsibility of populism is not, for populism is not, you know, a failure of autonomous movements or whatever, but sort of a result of that mode of refusal towards the liberal order.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's why we see a lot of, you know, movements that are there's a lot of indeterminate expressions of violence, of, you know, organized or not, or ambiguous movements are very heterogeneous and impure a lot of ways, and kind of buck against maybe how we'd like to see, you know, social movements form around what issues. But I think that, in that sense, it does speak to new organizing capacities or new moments for engaging in, you know, kind of interesting ways and rethinking questions about how we engage with things that seem to, you know, have this maybe ambiguous refusal. I think a lot of the texts try to get at that and speak with that, and, you know, varying levels of failure and success.
A good example of different antagonisms coming together would be, for instance, the Yellow Vest movement. But we'll talk a little bit about that later. Somebody said these rising movements aren't necessarily the force of the people per se, but what is left over when expressions of popular power are finished. An example would be the Democrats in the U.S., for instance, pushing Fight for 15 years after the movement first materialized, and at a time when, for instance, demanding $15 an hour is in itself demanding a poverty wage.
Yeah, this is actually one of the reasons why we chose the theme of populism to work with, you know, for this first issue of a project. Is because we felt like this phenomenon that's happening right now in America since, I guess, 2 years, everyone sort of had this wake-up call, you know, with Trump's election and then, you know, everything else that happened. But when we were talking about it with friends from elsewhere, we kind of realized that this kind of, you know, moments already happen in a lot of places. And actually, comrades, you know, either in Turkey or in Russia, you know, either Greece or Spain already had, you know, to struggle and to face these kind of moments of return, you know, where after a movement, like a broad social movement or uprising, you have like this moment of reaction or recuperation by a left-wing, you know, populism. And so that's kind of why we were hoping to really, yeah, put this project together to sort of like be able to also like overcome maybe this very American way of, you know, perceiving this historical moment as like something that's very unique or new, and, you know, kind of bring experiences from elsewhere also to reflect on that. Because, yeah, this has definitely happened in Spain with Podemos, you know, or Syriza in Greece, where yeah, like a left-wing populist sort of movement party, you know, something like quite hard to to grasp really feeds on a movement was just happening like 6 months ago in the streets, you know, and kind of recuperating and at the same time repressing the intensity and the modes of struggle of that movement. So yeah, it's really something that appears as like a common mode of functioning of those movements.
An autonomous anti-capitalist circles populist has always been thrown around as somewhat of a bad word. Are you all arguing that there is something to be, for instance, salvaged within populism, however?
I think it's not necessarily to just try to find a positive angle in populism, but I think it's, I don't know, I think it's important what our friend was saying about, you know, this wave of movements as a sort of wave of experimentation and learning. And I think that's maybe one of the things that we could, you know, think more thoroughly, like not to find like a positive side or something that could be defended in populism as it is seen from the liberal perspective, because populism as such is, it's also like a, you know, like sort of a phantom made by the liberal, you know, the liberal tradition, just to point out at anything that falls outside of itself. So we're not trying to, you know, like to make that idea ours and just like to, and just find whatever is good within it, but to understand them maybe as, yeah, like a wave of experimenting and learning and, but also like trying to open it up, opening like other, you know, meanings that are of people or that are not being, that are not falling within the typical populist understanding.
Right. I think maybe in engaging with this question, we also wanted to maybe provoke sort of a new perspective on some of the things. And yeah, like what, like you said, you know, in our radical circles, it sometimes they can, you know, something will be condemned as populist really fast because of a presence or the absence of certain symbols or practices, you know, inside that movement or that moment or whatever. In general, you know, if there is some property destruction, then it's good, and you know, if there's some a lot of national flags, and it's because it's nationalist, so it must be pro-fascist, so it's bad. And we kind of function with those dichotomies, maybe too much. And we kind of felt like the epoch we are living in right now, and the kind of movements and uprisings we're witnessing, you know, don't give us the luxury to be so so fast on judgment. And so we kind of wanted to, yeah, to address this question as sort of an open question, like, How do you approach a movement like the Yellow Vests, for example, you know, where they are an enormous presence of nationalist symbols and, you know, chants and flags and all that, and even racism or xenophobia. But, you know, at the same time, it has a very, very interesting potentials. And one of the first of them being reclaiming, you know, the term the people with a small p, you know, or the popular, saying, you know, we are coming from a position of the popular, and we kind of like claim this subject. So yeah, we kind of thought that there is definitely not something to keep from the populist strategy itself, and we really want to just escape from it. But at the same time, this moment of populism opens different interesting questions and challenges for revolutionaries, and is somehow pointing towards something as a, you know, possibility, an opening. So
seems like a lot of the book is inspired by what is happening in the U.S., where we have on one hand a sort of cult of personality around Trump, and then on the other things like the DSA and growing popularity of people like AOC and Bernie. What do you think this says about the situation of politics in the United States right now?
Yeah, maybe I could respond to that. Start by responding to that. I think it shows us a couple of things. I mean, I think in some sense, maybe this sounds comes off as a bit pessimistic, but it seems like, you know, what's so this order is kind of in crisis, the neoliberal order in decline. And so like these seem to be right now anyway, you know, we've got like the kind of turn to this more authoritarian capitalism in the figure of Donald Trump and the emergent right, alt-right, that, you know, presenting itself as this kind of, you know, project for a new order, you know. And then on the other hand, this kind of, you know, more recently, this nascent kind of social, you know, so-called socialist, but social democratic project and things like the Green New Deal. And I think, you know, obviously the DSA was very much there to catch a lot of its energy. And I think right now we're in a difficult position. I mean, I think we kind of have to keep building. I mean, you mentioned the right earlier and how the right had been able to co-opt, you know, the position of the anti-globalization movement and grow in a certain way. And you look at, you know, how over the past 20, 30 years, they've had, you know, a lot of organs of propaganda, you know, this kind of, you know, very kind of rich, extensive culture of talk shows, intellectual exchange. And I think it's kind of on us to, you know, build that kind of stuff, but kind of like our project and your project, you know, being able to reach a lot of people. And so otherwise, you know, I think we have to be open as well in how we engage with people recently coming into anti-capitalist politics and with an interest, because I think there's a lot of opportunity. And I think, you know, it's kind of a question of a different temporality to see how the DSA develops and the different tendencies within it. And, you know, eventually, you know, we know such a product's going to hit certain walls and people will be, you know, open to things, I think. So I think it's important to kind of also build more presence and be open to engaging on, you know, in shared projects, shared initiatives where possible. You know, I think it really depends from place to place, at least for the U.S. context. But maybe to add to what my friend was saying a little bit, that's kind of one of the interesting things about the book, is that we had met people from different places. And on this call, you know, I'm based in New York. My friends are based in Montreal and Mexico. I don't know if we'd mentioned that as an editorial collective, but it's to see how, you know, we have an image of something that, to put all these experiences together and to juxtapose them, you can see kind of like how they, you know, relate to each other, communicate with each other. So we can see kind of this image of maybe what we might face in the future. And that was kind of interesting how these themes emerged, not only in terms of populism both on the left and right, but there's also this, you know, the figure of natural disaster, and the theme of apocalypse kind of comes up in several of the texts, but the in particular the Japanese text deals with Fukushima, kind of the aftermath of Fukushima and how people organize in light of that. And anyone who's present to struggle in the U.S. Knows that, you know, there's been a lot of efforts at mutual aid in terms of the disasters that happened here. So it's interesting to see like resonances, and one of the reasons we felt this was important was to kind of put forward this project to kind of share experiences and analyses and be able to have an interesting exchange with people struggling in distant places. But in any case, I know that kind of gets off the topic of the U.S., but that's, you know, that's kind of my thoughts for what things might be like going forward. But it's really interesting times, of course. So
we had on the show in the past Carney Ross, an anarchist that at one point was a UK diplomat and left during the Iraq War. And we asked him about the rise of the far right in Europe, and he replied, actually, it was the situation is much worse in the United States, where we have elected Trump as president. This brings up an interesting tension where I think a lot of people in the U.S. are watching what is happening in Europe. For instance, you know, the massive marches in, for instance, like Poland, or the rise of the AfD in Germany, or the Golden Dawn, as much more frightening than the sort of bumbling idiot who we hear about on late night when pundits make jokes about.
No, it's interesting you say that. I mean, in some sense, like how you're describing it makes it even seem more scary because it's so banal.
Right.
You know, but it's like this disavowal we have that. And I think it has to do with kind of, you know, our ability to talk about it or not. But, you know, in some way, it's like we have this this kind of inclination to talk about this crisis or impending crisis in a way that is in the future tense or, you know, almost here, but it's really we're living it in a weird
exactly.
way.
So exactly.
It's, fascism is clearly here. So it's an interesting, very dark way with how that's processed culturally or something.
Or like right now, there are more people being stopped on the border and being held in internment camps than there have been in past years. And the Pentagon is, for instance, sending troops to the border, et cetera, et cetera. And there's hardly any public discussion on it in the mainstream media. This is seen as the new normal while the news concentrates on the latest dumb thing Trump has said on social media.
Right, exactly. Well, exactly. And this is kind of part of the phenomenon, right, that something can rise with such intensity on precisely like the denial of the real conditions and the real violence that the U.S. is built on and, still maintained itself on. This is exactly the conditions that gave the possibility of something like Trump and its, his propaganda to erect to power. This sort of like spectacular funneling of all energies or whatever. And the sad thing, looking at it from kind of more a distance from Montreal, from Canada, looking at the state of the political game in the U.S. right now, it seems like in the face of this, this bad populism, like, let's say, promoting bad values and, bad discourse or whatever, like the only option a lot of people are seeing is just, well, let's promote the good populism, let's fight fake news with real news, real facts, and let's try to propose a figure of the people that is like the real people, we are the workers, we are the real citizens, and Trump's supporters are just like bigots and fascists or whatever. But one of the discussions we are trying to raise with this book and when we toured in the US is really how can we even escape, this kind of terrain that's set up for us where someone like Bernie Sanders can, come in. And I mean, it's not about him as a person. Of course, it's just like he's just this symbol or this totem of this bigger organizing behind him. And one of the images we discussed on the talks is this image of, Bernie launching his campaign, in 2015. And there was like 20 reporters and that's it. There's no one, for him. And, his campaign speech in Brooklyn a couple of weeks ago where there was like 10 or 15,000 people that showed up, like huge crowd of people. And so this is seen right now, like this image is promoted as like this is hope, this is what we should be enthusiastic and working for, like all these people showed up for Bernie, so there's a chance of beating Trump and all that. Like we know this discourse by heart, but you can actually look at this image and find it quite sad, seeing 10,000, 15,000 people showing up to just be behind this one figure that is supposed to challenge Trump on its own terrain, the terrain of demagogy, basically, representing a better discourse or a stronger kind of intensifying, effective mobilization of the American people, but still keeping exactly the same terms, the American people. What is it? What is a good American? What is it seems as if in some way the political situation in the US is opening up because some things that people were not able to discuss before, like socialism or even the revolution, these terms are coming back again. But at the same time, it seems that it's closing on itself because really the terrain of the conflict is invested in a way that, you can basically just be on one side or the other, and there's like no third way. There's no escaping that. So this is what this book tries to put forward, is like, ideas and experiences from elsewhere, trying to create this like a new path, another path or something. Just one more round with my friends. And I hope this never ends, because today's my time to play.
Every dog has his day. Some want the bone, some chase the cars. I'm leaving more than a stain. Let me get it all, won't settle for the so-called luxuries in life. That's such a cheesy line. Calling a bluff, doing it for more than the fame. Come on. Give me freedom of speech, give me equal rights. Give me clean air to breathe on a peaceful night. Give me whatever it takes to break our chains and make us see the light. Give me just a little bass and a bit of space to let me speak my mind. Won't you please just let me play?
Here we go again.
Give me space enough for me to breathe, enough for me to be, enough for me to play. I don't ask for much, you just pass the Dutch coffee Africa, I'm okay. I feel fabulous, the one to have a buck, it's acidus, trying to rhyme after us. The checkmate and imagine us, they lack the nuts and hits with the laughter stuff. He goes, oh no, look at them go, Mr. Saint, literary, daddy pale promo, see the logo, bro, my dog, since I'm stone cold, flow bros, acting loco, take it global, get it low, don't for left the place, see my bros, you never separate,
he goes, just one more round with my friends, and I hope this never ends, because today's my time to play. Here we go again. Just one more round with my friends, and I hope this never ends, because today's my time to play.
Is that true, though, that there is no third way? Despite how hard liberals tried to sell the midterm, still a lot of poor and working people didn't vote, and much of the proletariat remains removed from the so-called tribalism of electoral politics. And I think if you look at the current social movements, from the fight against pipelines to the growth of teacher wildcat strikes, there's a growing component within those that pushes back against the institutional left and the Democrats, and that's probably the most important part. And the rate in which people are becoming politicized, for instance, in the last few weeks, we're seeing high school students walk out around climate change, which flew under the radar of many radicals. I think the other aspect is the degree in which these people are going to become disillusioned with, for instance, the DSA's electoralism or people like Bernie Sanders or AOC. As they become not able to deliver the things that they promised, much as we saw Black Lives Matter in part erupting due to many people that voted for him simply feeling like he didn't deliver.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think we agree. I agree. I think there's definitely these flashpoints of potential, and I think that's just kind of the, you know, really the time that we live in, you know. I think I don't know if periodizing is always kind of can be a dicey game, but at least, you know, I think from my experience from New York since Occupy, since what's kind of open since then. So I think it's very much, I don't think it's foreclosed. I think it's very much an open question. And as you say, you know, people are going to get, you know, this tired of it and see what it brings. So I think that's kind of, you know, one reason we felt the project was important, at least. You know, from our experience in the U.S. as part of the project, but, I think it behooves us to kind of be active and engage in stuff and be out there and in contact with people. And, you know, I think, I mean, maybe in some circles that I've been a part of, relating to strikes or, you know, relating in an interesting way to some labor movements hasn't necessarily been, at the forefront of the kind of struggles that have, people have been involved in. You know, there's, you know, a lot of stuff around, police and other stuff, but I think we see this with comrades throughout the U.S. as well. But, you know, I think it's good for us to really be looking and engaging in all types of struggles in this way, you know, that might not be outside the, you know, more ideological purview of our, of some focus, but it's not always an easy thing to figure out how to do, but I think there's people doing interesting things here.
Just moving on, how can autonomous anti-capitalists of all stripes step up our game in the context of rising populism?
It's a hard question beyond thinking, you know, reaching people and I think engaging tactfully, engaging in open, being open, engaging in tactful ways. And I'm not sure if anyone has anything to add.
Yeah, I think one of the things we kind of talked about a lot in the discussions, the place we went, is how do you not become just like a caricature, or, you know, how do you not play this role that they want you to play in a way? And this really comes like, it's a discursive question. It's also a practical question. In times where, when there is this desire to create scary figures, or, you know, like enemies of the people kind of figures, how do you escape? So how do you flee? How do you create other perceptions? And instead of being, you know, interpolated to answering their questions, or, you know, standing on the ground that they created and sort of using the divisions and the terms that they have created for you, you kind of like reframe questions in the way that we find, you know, relevant. So this really helps to create another perception of a situation and sort of reopening an imagination of what the political means, even, you know, and not playing just on the terrain of the political and being like, well, we have to defend these values, you know, or these people or whatever. But actually, like, redefining even what it is to do politics and kind of, you know, build something together in common. I guess that's a really abstract answer to your question. But it's really something that seems, yeah, really important for us, even in terms of like aesthetical or ethical, components of what a movement is, you know, what a position is. Really try to dig deep into those questions. So sort of create like other levels of perception, really, of analysis and ideas.
I think it's also like reopening and reimagining what the political is, but it can also mean, or at least that's what we're seeing here in Mexico, is like also trying to position ourselves within a different tradition, to the liberal and even the left populist claim to the people. There's something really interesting going on down here right now, because this year marks the 100th year's anniversary of the assassination of Emiliano Zapata, which I suppose you know was like the great leader of the peasant movement in the revolution of the early 20th century, and it's like the big, you know, symbol for the Zapatistas and all the people who are struggling for land and territories. So the government is trying to has officially called this the year of Zapata, and they're doing all of these symbolic acts, trying to claim history, while at the same time trying to impose a huge project, an energy project in Morelos and Puebla and Tlaxcala, which were the actual Zapatista territories. So there's a very, very sometimes subtle, sometimes not so much, like, struggle for, you know, position, from where do you reclaim a certain history, a certain tradition, a certain genealogy. So, for example, a lot of people in those states were maybe toying with the idea of supporting a left populist government, are now, since the imposition of this huge project, trying to rebuild and look deeper within the within themselves, their traditions, their own oral history, to, you know, like pull some strength, political strength, from within. I don't know if this makes sense. Like trying to rebuild their own tradition and rebuild their own genealogies to have like a very strong position against, you know, like a symbolic capture or co-optation of one of their most, you know, important figures.
Curious if you can talk more about the situation in Mexico. On one hand, we know that there is a growth of communities, for instance, expelling the state and declaring autonomy. And on the other, we know that the EZLN toyed last year with running a candidate in the last election. What else can you say on all of this and how it all fits together?
Well, it's a very broad story. The presidential candidacy thing that you mentioned was proposal not just from the ECLN, but the ECLN and the National Indigenous Congress. And it was more of a sort of a, they even called it sort of a diversion tactic, right? To position a character within the media sphere as sort of a pretext to strengthen their own organization. So it was really a very strange moment. But it was, in the end, it was like, it gave the National Indigenous Congress specifically a lot of strength that it hadn't had in maybe 10 years since 2006 and the last, you know, huge ECLN movement. So it was really, now that we, like 2 years after that, it was a very complicated bureaucratic process to actually get someone on the ballot. So we lost that, of course, but 2 years after that, the National Indigenous Congress is much more strong than it was, right? So afterwards, López Obrador was elected. So from the perspective of ECL, I don't know if you heard or read the January 1st declaration of the ECLN, which is pretty much, it's a very intense discourse, even like warlike discourse, where they're saying, of course, López Obrador is the continuity of all neoliberalist politics. He's going to be even more violent towards us because he has pointed at us like as their enemies. So we are defending ourselves. So we have to go back to our territories and be strong. And they were saying if they come to get us, we're gonna answer back. So it's kind of a very, I don't know if you heard, but in this Morelos situation, a friend of ours, a very close friend of ours, was murdered less than a month ago, Samir Flores, just like 10 days after López Obrador was talking or called the resistance movement against the project in Morelos, he called our friends in Morelos left-wing conservatives that were trying to stop progress in Morelos. And he actually pointed at them during a speech and 10 days after our friend was murdered just outside his home. So it's kind of a very, you know, to link it with the populist question here, what's really strange and really subtle, and it's a very complicated thing, and I think it touches with what our friend was saying about engaging tactfully with people or certain movements, is that the whole discourse of, coming from López Obrador is that he uses the word people, pueblo all the time. So, for example, he's doing some sort of, consults to approve his, project to have, and his discourse is that the people are actually deciding every project. But of course, he's not, consulting the directly affected people, but the whole country. And specifically the country where he has more support, the place of the country where he has more support. It's been very hard to argue and to make a visible opposition and to gain support for resistance movements, because they are, you know, using all of our discourses. He's even said he is governing mandando obedeciendo, which is like the basic principle of the Zapatistas, right? Like, I don't know how to translate that.
Right.
to govern by obeying the people, right? So it's been very hard to, you know, like the resistance movement that is mainly nucleated around the National Indigenous Congress, it's still going and still strong, and it has its strongholds in Oaxaca and in Michoacán and in Chiapas, and it has very interesting and intense and potent autonomy spaces. But the strategy they're using is to isolate that spaces, those spaces, with violence, as in the case of Samir, but also with a very basic and appealing populistic discourse. So I think, yeah, our main challenge right now is, just as he was saying, you know, to reach tactfully some people that are maybe toying with the idea that he's actually governing for the people, you know?
When we think about the crisis from climate change to fascism, we often present it as something that is on the horizon, when in reality, it's already here. Curious if you think that as the crisis deepens, will populism itself also deepen as well?
You mean that the crisis, the populism will...
For instance, like 10 years from now, well, instead of demonizing immigrants, populists instead will be demonizing robots. With all of these things across the board happening, do you see a deepening mutation of the strands of populism?
I definitely think that we'll see, I think that's an interesting way you put it, a world of monsters, of strange deep mutations. But yeah, I think going forward, definitely, as the crisis deepens, I think there will be, you know, populism will subsist. On the other hand, I guess I think there will also be probably a deepening relevance for the kind of forms of and practices that an autonomous politics can offer. So, you know, I think if we position ourselves in meaningful ways and can be meaningful and relevant to people's lives, I think that would be how to think about the question.
Yeah, I think maybe looking at it from here, I'm thinking specifically in Argentina or Brazil, for example, where there was like a first wave of left populism and then like a counter attack from the far right, specifically with a character like Bolsonaro, which is like, is absolutely crazy. But I think, yeah, I mean, I agree. It doesn't look like populism is going to fade. But what I see, at least from some friends in Brazil, is that this counterattack from the far right is making a lot of people, you know, like getting in touch in different ways, aside or outside from the liberal democratic spectrum, and starting to organize with, you know, once this far right reality is kicking them in the face, like starting to think and to build other type of strategies, encounters, autonomy spaces, even, you know, like self-defense tactics, you know. So I don't see this wave of populism like fading, but I do see that opening like spaces for new forms of organization.
Don't know if you would agree with this, but definitely it seems like since 2016, we've seen an acceleration of things popping off. And then with the midterms, we saw a major shift towards a return back to the center and politics as usual.
Yeah, I think that seems like a fair assessment to me. It's kind of and it was crazy, the effort being, you know, I mean, I don't know, here in New York, I saw like graffiti for voting on the street. Yeah. So, you know, everything's up for recuperation, appropriation, apparently, the Democratic.
What did the graffiti say?
I don't know. You know, it looked really cool. I don't know. So, you know, something that was like hip and to the point that I didn't even, you know, I wasn't, maybe it was meant to be a little ironic, but
right.
It was indiscernible at first. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I think there's a lot. I think one of the challenges too is making these, you know, finding some consistency within these, you know, kind of disparate movements that we participate in, that we see happening. And, you know, I mean, it's hard when a window closes too.
People within the alt-right have attempted to frame the battles of the future in terms of nationalism versus globalism, where our position would be autonomy versus the state. I'm just curious, as we discuss the rise of all of these different forces, do we have to seriously think about how to repackage or represent our ideas in such a changing world?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how you put the question, sort of pointing to this operation of sort of, them recuperating our terms or our ideas. And this is usually how we approach this question. You know, we sort of see the loss and become melancholic very easily, you know, about past struggles and all that and how they've been recuperated. Another way of seeing it would be, you know, to approach a question in terms of like, how do we steal their terrain? So when they, you know, take on these oppositions, like nationalism versus globalism, and how can we displace that elsewhere, you know, by participating and being really part of movements in the core of them. And this comes back to what I was saying a little bit earlier about this idea that it's not necessarily about how we present our ideas per se, but I think there's definitely something fuller to waiting to be built, you know, or to be created. In terms of, aesthetical, ethical, maybe even spiritual sides, there is definitely something missing right now in the way that most radical projects or, you know, groups are approaching the question of how do you talk to people? And even in the fact that the question is framed in that way, so like how do we speak to the people or the population, there is already something there that kind of diverts us maybe from how can we actually be effective is maybe through thinking ourselves as being, you know, part of that population more than trying to mobilize it or, you know, like spread our propaganda against another propaganda. So really having this strong idea of a truth that, you know, we can share basically would make it, I think, like constitutes one of the ways that we can sort of ride the wave of this moment of populism and sort of create something new. And this maybe brings us back also to we published a couple of letters coming from France, coming from comrades that are, you know, witnessing and participating obviously in the Yellow Vest movement. And that movement really, I think a lot of people, you know, saw different texts on it and reports, but really confused at first a lot of the more traditional, let's say, anarchist or activist circles, because it kind of had a lot of imagery and symbols that sort of reminded of the far right, and then there was all of those questions, you know, of manipulation and all that came up. And one of the interesting texts that came from France and was translated actually into English that I came on was one from Alice de Lambria, who is an Italian author but writes in French, and he has this interesting idea where, you know, the elements of the far right or the populist elements in this movement are, you know, basically coming from this world. These are effects and symbols that this world kind of, you know, produces in people, and in engaging with that kind of those kind of effects or moments, the populist tendency would, you know, sort of go in the way of you know, kind of pandering these effects or trying to work with them, sort of, you know, like to please the people and say, okay, you want to use the French nationalist imaginary, well, let's, you know, I'll just go there with you, you know, like most of the leftist parties actually did in France. After maybe 1 month of mobilization, they kind of went, okay, let's, you know, let's try to recuperate this one too. Totally changing, you know, like their discourse basically to please that. And a revolutionary attitude in face, you know, in the face of something like that is more to try to give birth to new forms of sensibility in this struggle, so really reseparate it in other ways, like recut the division in ways that are like more interesting or seem more truthful to us. I don't know. I think there's definitely going to be, at least for a lot of comrades before and after Yellow Vest, you know, in our collective history and the way we think and approach, you know, social movements, because it's definitely one that's really been really challenging and in a lot of ways. And yeah, presenting this figure of like the return of like a, you know, populace basically, or a pleb population where you weren't expecting that anymore, you know, in a country like France, is really an interesting phenomenon, you know, something that might point out to this, you know, old kind of joke of, you know, that some friends often tell, where it's the revolutionary who believes the less in revolution sometimes, you know, and when it comes, you know, knocking at his door, it's, you know, the revolutionary is not ready because it was waiting for it to appear somewhere else, you know.
About the Yellow Vest a little bit, as it has been painted as a populist surge that deals with everything from class to climate change, but also as a force that doesn't come out of the traditional left or the trade unions.
Exactly. One of the letters that came out of Paris, like maybe a couple of weeks after it all started in November, was already pointing out to this. We published it on our website. It kind of said, you know, anyone who's trying to understand and interpret this movement with old ideological categories is just completely mistaken and will never understand it. And this was kind of like, you know, this crisis here in our frameworks of interpretation. So like the Marxist, everyone who's basically from a Marxist tradition was trying to, yeah, have like a class analysis of it. Are they workers? Are they, you know, are they organized as workers and what's going on? And, you know, and the more moral kind of leftist position was trying to see if, yeah, they were right-wing fascist, actually, you know, disguised as a social movement and all that. And really, what was really the situation was really calling for like this radical, you know, I guess, opening to just like be there and see and participate in it. And the one position that this letter was advocating for was really, well, just by being there, we can change the course of the struggle.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good point. And, you know, we kind of watched that happen. And I think it speaks to the logic that, you know, a lot of the articles are trying to get at, in the book, of populism being this kind of very malleable thing. You know, the movement had this kind of very malleable signifier in the form of the Yellow Vest. And it was almost, in some way also, it's obviously, well, I think it was at once kind of a potential and limit of the movement because, you know, it allowed for like all this kind of at the beginning, all this different stuff to happen. And it was all kind of codified and read and talked about as one movement. Anybody who kind of had a yellow vest on, you know, and it allowed for a lot of struggles to kind of join it. But then on the other hand, you know, it's kind of a question of, that's one thing happening in France, but then how that, you know, and I think this is an interesting question that our project is kind of set up to think about is how movements, travel, you know, how like ideas or movements spread from one place to another. And, you know, it's kind of took because of Trump and because the right was on it and, you know, kind of made up that it was, you know, this anti-global, you know, specifically anti-globalist, pro-Trump kind of movement was able to kind of like present it in a certain way. And, you know, really it's a weird, it speaks to kind of the prevalence of social media and the, you know, the spectacle of representation and how that plays a role in.
Just curious, you know, in the U.S., the alt-right was super excited about the yellow vest movement. However, I think we experienced it seeing so many people driving out fascists from the streets in France. But at the same time, you know, the age we live in, just like with the Ukrainian uprising or even during the early period of Occupy, when something big like this pops off, the fascists will also be there. And I think we have to be prepared to wage that struggle within the struggle and push back against racist, anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant groups and positions within these broader constellations of antagonisms.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And we, you know, we kind of, those of us who were following it, you know, from our editorial collective and other friends, you know, kind of saw that happen where it was, we had gotten reports of the movement and heard, you know, what people were saying, who was involved and what was about, you know, initially this kind of tax revolt. And then to see, you know, I don't even know how to say it, the Twitter sphere or whatever, take it up, you know, the alt-right kind of take this up in social media. It was, you know, it was unexpected, but that's the game that's being played.
Or like with Trump retweeting that bullshit about people chanting during the yellow vest protest, Trump, Trump, which actually wasn't actually real. But it's also funny that the alt-right and Trump supporters were literally cheering this on and cheering on a movement that was, you know, if it had broken out in the U.S., it literally would have been labeled Antifa and the National Guard would have been sent in to stop people from rioting, looting, and burning stuff.
I guess it speaks, what you're saying, it speaks a lot about the plasticity or the flexibility of populist discourse and how it can adapt, you know, when it sees an opportunity or an intensity that it can work with, it can totally adapt. So we cannot really limit our comprehension of something like the alt-right or left-wing populism to the old limits, you know, of civility or of legality, because actually, like, one of the first things that sort of came up with Trump's campaign was the question of violence, you know, was reopened again, like real, you know, interpersonal or street violence was actually, you know, asked by his supporters. So it definitely challenges us to think about those things in fresh terms and to, up our game, as you say.
It's interesting how that violence and property destruction was seen as legitimate, where if it would have been in a different context, just a little bit differently, it would have been totally condemned.
I mean, I think on the one hand, we've seen, you know, kind of this, just more and more examples of this kind of logic appear in places. And it's actually interesting to hear our friend from Mexico talk a little bit more about it, because, you know, in spite of how radically different the situations are, to hear, you know, to see the, you know, kind of how autonomous movements have to, you know, look at this question of relating to populism, relating to especially left-wing populism. So I think on the one hand, yeah, I think we've seen it, you know, like there's more examples of stuff that we've seen emerge in here and abroad. To speak, you know, quickly to the experience in New York, a lot of friends were mobilizing against Amazon moving to New York City. And I don't want to get into it, but for a number of factors, I think, you know, AOC's rise, local rise has been really important. And I think more than anything in this case, it was the Queens political machine kind of had to adjust and at least to speak this game of progressive politics, and saw kind of an opportunity for it. And so that kind of in conjunction with the DSA mobilizing around it, but also there were a lot, you know, a lot of other kind of grassroots initiatives, nonprofits involved, people organizing, anarchists organizing, more, you know, kind of more autonomous kind of tendencies getting involved. But it was interesting after they decided not to come here, which happened quite recently. The DSA kind of said, you know, it was the people of Queens. They were quoted somewhere, I think maybe it was in a Jacobin article or somewhere else, saying that it was the people of Queens that kind of rose up and, you know, kept Amazon from coming. But in reality, it wasn't, you know, it's still, that was still very much mobilizing the specter of populism. Because in reality, that was kind of a fiction. There was a, you know, relatively small group of, you know, people that had the conviction that this shouldn't happen. And from very different, you know, maybe walks of life or different ways of seeing the issue, but it came together around it. We're organizing around it. And I think the way the governor Cuomo characterized it as a negative minority was, much more kind of accurate. But anyway, in any case, there's one more thing I want to say. So, yeah, that in terms of kind of seeing other examples of this logic at work. The other thing is that when we were at a talk, at the ZAD in France, this, you know, the occupation against the airport, I'm sure you guys have talked about it on here, that eventually won and the airport wasn't constructed in this place, in France. We gave talking there about the book, there was, they were kind of pushed back, and I think someone mentioned this earlier, in the evening, but, to kind of support the idea of the popular and talk about how that was like a very, very important thing in terms of organizing with several, you know, several different kinds of people and being able to kind of tap into these popular practices, of tradition or maybe traditional practices of, you know, maybe more or less communal types of, traditions or other forms of relating in the country and kind of reinventing those in struggle. So they kind of, you know, they were saying, okay, you know, we agree with what you're saying about populism, but the category of the popular has actually been very important to us in relating to struggles. I'm sure people could speak to other things. So.
Like, continue what I was saying before, like, right here, populism. Like, it's on the news every day, being discussed on the liberal spectrum, agenda, whatever. You know, and there's all the liberal whining about, you know, López Obrador is being, you know, like a danger to democratic stability and whatever. So I think our challenge mainly is to, as we were saying, I think we all have said that at one point in this interview, to like to position ourselves outside of that and try to create another field. Like we have to create a whole different field to discuss and confront these issues, because we have to reclaim what's, at least in Mexico, there's, you know, there's a very strong political tradition coming from the people and the, you know, like the indigenous and peasant movement. So we have to kind of reclaim that tradition and genealogy and not let it be, you know, taken away to, you know, put it as a sort of, mythology, symbolic order of the power of the state power. So we have to, you know, as our other friend was saying, like create the whole, a whole different spectrum, field, space of what is politics, of new imagination, discourses, modes of interacting and of organizing, especially when, because, you know, I don't know if that's the case in all of the places that are, you know, discussed in the book or even where, I'm going to listen to this, but right here we are very much pressed. You know, it's our history and our struggles and our stories that are being taken away from us also. So that is a very complicated and a very minefield place that we're stepping, because, you know, we don't we have to be able to engage with people who are not, you know, as close to our movements, as close to our organization. We have to speak directly to us without having to be mediated by the state and all its symbolic, you know, gestures. we have to create our own. And I think that it's like, you know, like our most present challenge.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with us. And it's great to have such great comrades on the show across so many different miles and borders. What's next and works for this project? And will there be another book, another tour? And also, where can people get a copy of the current issue?
Yeah, I could speak to that real quick. So it's published by Common Notions. You can find their website easily online in the U.S. It's translated into French. There will be a forthcoming Spanish edition as well that our friends in Mexico have helped out with. If you go to our website, liaisonshq.com, so it's liaisonshq.com, you can find information about buying the book as well. There we have this, in addition to kind of the, you know, you can find links about the book. We also have this, practice of correspondence. So we have, as, our friend was saying earlier, we have this practice of people writing letters, talking about their local situation. So there's actually a really interesting letter, from earlier last year from Mexico. There's the letters that were mentioned from, France, a letter from, a friend from the Ukraine, and there's going to soon be up something about recent mobilizations in Algeria, an interview with someone.
Oh, wow, fascinating.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's something that's kind of an ongoing thing as we meet people, as we travel and go to places, you know, getting to know people and trying to hear from their particular experiences and have them write us a letter. You can reach us at liaisons@riseup.net as well. What else? We're planning on, you know, maybe trying to make it out to the West Coast later this year, but that's still kind of in the works. And we're also working on a new book that will probably come out in France in the fall and hopefully at the beginning of the year in English. I don't know, maybe if someone else wants to talk more about that.
We can be back on the show when that is out or
yeah,
something.
That's true.
Yeah, but there's definitely, the project is continuing. There's more people expressing interest, you know, in that kind of writing and joining. And yeah, we're just excited, you know, to have this platform for, you know, sharing and thought and analysis from this very, you know, let's say marginal point of view, and just continuing meeting people through it and, yeah, building something.
What can you tell us about the next issue of Liaisons?
No, yeah. So the theme of the second one is supposed to be on minor horizons. And I guess people will have to find out what this is by reading the book.
Okay.
That's a teaser. Yeah, it's on the question of minor horizons. And I won't go into it. Maybe we'll just, people will have to find out.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. Anything else you want to say?
Thanks so much for having us. It's been a great conversation, and look forward to talking more. And hopefully it could be, you know, you could find a text you're interested in if you check out the website, check out the book.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.